You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or subscribe to Brookings Podcasts through iTunes or your favorite podcast app. You can also follow us on Twitter at @policypodcasts.
Well, good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Brookings Institution and welcome to another in our series of events of the Brookings Intelligence Project. It was a great pleasure for me this morning to spend an hour and a half with you and with Kathy Scott Clark, co-author of what I think is one of the most important books that will come out this year, The Exile. I'll explain why I think that in just a minute. I want to begin by asking you to please mute your cell phones, so we don't have a competition as to who has the best cell phone. I'd also ask you to bear with the program. We're going to proceed in the following manner. I will have a conversation with Kathy for about 45 minutes or so, until about 9:45, and then we will open it up to questions from you. When we go to questions from the audience, could you please identify yourself and your affiliation, just so we know the background to the questioner. Recent events, tragic events, in London and in Manchester have underscored the importance of the world getting a better understanding of where the global jihad came from and how it has evolved. One of the biggest lacunas in understanding the development of the global jihad has been what happened to Osama bin Laden in the decade between September 11th and May 2011, when he was finally brought to justice in Abbottabad, Pakistan. This very dark period has been a subject of much mystery in the years since he was found in Abbottabad. The exile, the stunning inside story of Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda in flight, fills this lacuna and tells us what was going on. It's a really remarkable story, and it's a remarkable example of investigative journalism at its very, very best. Kathy Scott Clark and Adrian Levy are two of the finest investigative journalists anywhere in the world. I'm a very big fan of their works. They've produced a number of really important books, including the most important book about Dr. A.Q. Khan, the great nuclear pirate of our times, and an even more stunning book called The Siege about 2611, the Lashkar-e-Taiba attack on the city of Mumbai, and in particular on the Taj Hotel. In this book, they take us inside the period of time that Osama bin Laden is hiding after September 11th until he's finally found. They also look at his family, his wives and his children, and where they were hiding, and the interconnections between them. It's a complicated story. I think it's safe to say there are a lot of zigs and zags. We don't move in a simple straight line, especially the family. But it's a very important and compelling story for a number of reasons, not the least of which is that it helps us understand better how the Pakistani and Iranian deep states, as they're often called, facilitated hiding Osama bin Laden and his family. And particularly the role that Iran played in all of this, I think, is very important, new, and quite timely, given where relations between the West and Iran seem to be moving. The story, as I said, has many, many components. I'd like to start questions with a very simple component, though, which is sourcing. The book is remarkably well sourced, as you can see if you look in the footnotes. How did you get all these people to talk, and who were the people who played the role in giving you the information you're looking for?
The first step, I think, was I was working in Pakistan a lot in 2011 and 12. I was there when he was killed, and my immediate thought was, what about the family and the children who remained in Pakistan for months and months afterwards? I really wanted to hear what they had to say about kind of the years on the run with him, the years in Abbottabad, whether they agreed with what he'd done, whether they agreed with 9/11. I mean, who were these people? So I started with them, and I thought, how do you get Osama's family to talk to you? And I was lucky in that they were held by the ISI, Pakistani Intelligence, for almost a year afterwards. And the brother of Amal, who's the youngest wife, came from Yemen to try and get his sister out and her five children. And he didn't have a clue how to work the system in Pakistan. He only spoke Arabic. He didn't have any money. He'd spent the family club together, all their finances, to get him the ticket to Islamabad. And so I gave him some assistance in terms of directing him, kind of, this is how the court system works. And in return, when he finally got them freed, he then introduced me to his sister and her kids. And then we kind of went from there onwards. I mean, it was this, it took a long time. I mean, 5 years altogether, to get the full confidence of certain members of the family. And there are certain members of the family I haven't talked to. And then once that was kind of established, that there was a book to be written, because we could actually get access to people who had seen it from the inside, which was the full intention, was to see Al-Qaeda from the inside. We obviously couldn't just stick with the kind of domestic affairs. We wanted to look at how the organisation had worked and how it had come together with the 9/11 plot, and whether or not that was a unified decision to go for that target, and what happened to the organisation afterwards. So I sat down with Adrian, and we kind of drew up a list of, okay, within the movement itself, within the active officers of Al-Qaeda, who's still alive, who's not in Guantanamo or in detention elsewhere, and who in theory could we talk to. And we gradually went through that quite short list of people, and one meeting led to another meeting, so going to Mauritania to meet Osama's former spiritual advisor kind of gave us some, I guess, brownie points with other people who then said, well, if he meets you, then we'll meet you. So then I met people in Jordan like Abu Muhammad al-Maqdisi, who is a huge jihad theologist. And so, yes, it was a kind of, it was a very slow, gradual process of creeping forwards and gaining confidence. I think it's probably the wrong word, but gaining trust.
And just as you got to that point, surprise, surprise, the U.S. government actually divulged some of the documents that it's found in Abu Dhabi.
Yes.
And I think...
which really helped. Really helped.
As far as I can tell, you and Adrian are the first people to really go through, especially the largest tranche of documents, and connect the dots in that.
Yeah, and we obviously don't claim any of that as our original material. I mean, it was out there for people to read. But it was just, I remember printing everything out, and it was just a huge stack of papers. And initially, it was quite difficult to understand some of the, like, I mean, it was translated into English, but difficult to understand the language and difficult to work out the relationships between particularly family members. But having been given information by the family, then the letters began to make more sense of kind of, and you could just start to piece together sort of who was coming from where and who was the son that was mentioned here. And the letters were hugely important and still remain so, because there's more than a million documents that have not been released.
Right.
And will now not be released, which I find incredible.
We know from the accounts of the SEALs that they only got a small percentage of the documents in Abu Dhabi. They had to leave most of them behind.
Yep.
So until the ISI opens up its files, which I don't anticipate is going to happen in my lifetime, there will be a huge amount of secrecy about this.
But there's still a million documents that are here that are not going to be released, which I find, frankly, unbelievable.
Let's turn to bin Laden himself. Here is the most wanted man in human history, the target of the biggest manhunt ever, with almost every intelligence service in the world trying to capture him or kill him or find him or do something. And for 10 years, he successfully evades it. One of the things that struck me about the book is that you have upended the picture that we were given when he was found. The picture we were given was that this was, quote, the lion in winter, a man who sat there watching old videos of himself in a kind of pathetic way, cut off from the world. But in the book, we discover he was actually a very, very busy person. For example, one of the early things you say is, in 2002, I guess, he was in Karachi and met with Richard Reed, the famous shoe bomber, and dispatched him on his way. How would you characterize bin Laden's level of activity and his involvement in al-Qaeda in this decade or so?
I think in the early years after 9/11, he particularly and Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who was the real architect of this operation, were so buoyed up by the success and astounded by what they had achieved. It sounds a terrible thing to say, but I don't think any of them believed that they would pull this off, that they felt they were untouchable. And Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, from people who know him, I mean, obviously I haven't interviewed him, but was a figure who believed he could control the world. He could do anything he wanted and nobody would ever touch him. And I think I do believe he felt like that until the moment that he was picked up in Rawalpindi in March 2003. And he encouraged Osama bin Laden to feel the same way. I mean, we've done this, we can do anything, we can go anywhere we want, we have total protection in Pakistan, I have my sources, my family, my networks in Karachi and elsewhere. And this was a huge kind of consternation to other members of al-Qaeda, like Saif al-Adel, who was the head of the military council, who by this stage was in Iran. He was so worried about the risks that these two were taking in travelling around and meeting and plotting crazy stuff, flying planes into Heathrow Airport, which thankfully didn't happen, that he wrote a letter to Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, which, again, is not our material. I mean, this is already out there, saying, look, you've got to stop rushing and encouraging the Sheikh. He's unhinged and his mind is not kind of in the right place at the moment, so please just back off, because we don't want our legacy to be one where we're seen as having no control over what we're doing. So, I mean, obviously later on, Osama's movements were curtailed by his physical living situation. But I mean, his mind and his activities and his desires and his intentions were all still there.
You mentioned that they had a network of people, and you identify some of them in the book, like Fazul Rahman Khalil, Ahmed Gul, and the head of Lashkar-e-Taiba, Hafez Saeed. How did that work? How much did those people know where he was? I mean, physically versus knew how to contact him, maybe through connections. And then, of course, the common thread of those three people is they all have a connection one way or another to the Pakistani intelligence service, the ISI. How did this process work as you look back on it?
Well, I think, I mean, it started with Hamid Gul, who was the former director general of the ISI, who I interviewed many times from 1995 onwards. In the early days, I had no idea he had a kind of... After 9/11, I didn't initially know that he had an ongoing bin Laden connection. But, I mean, they had known each other since the Soviet war in the 80s, and they had a mutual admiration. And he would quite happily talk about it in his interviews, as I imagine all journalists know that went to see him, that he was a great fan. And I think it worked both ways. And so when Osama needed assistance before Abbottabad, but around the Abbottabad time when they were first setting up the house and they were building and working out a cloak of invisibility, he offered his assistance then. And he talked a little bit about it, not a great deal.
Right.
But evidence that he knew how to contact Osama and knew exactly where he was. I mean, you just look again at the letters that General Pasha, who was the head of the ISI in 2010 and 11, wanted to reach out to al-Qaeda and talk about some kind of peace deal, because there were so many attacks in Pakistan at that time. And he went through Hamid Gul, said, look, you can be our emissary. And Fazlur Rahman Khalil also went along. And he talked, I met him as well on several occasions, Fazlur and Khalil. He talked about Azama, and we had a long dispute at one stage about whether Hamza bin Laden, the son, had been in the house just before Osama was killed. In fact, Fazlur Rahman Khalil got very upset and said, "Look, you don't know what you're talking about. I know exactly where he was, and this was that," and kind of pride factor helped get the information out.
Of course, it's you know, for outsiders looking at Pakistan, which, as you know better than almost anyone else, is a complicated house of mirrors, to put it mildly.
And a great country.
How could someone like Hamid Gul know, or Khalil knew, or even better, Hafez Saeed know, and the Pakistani intelligence service doesn't know, or appears not to know?
Well, everyone describes sort of the ISI, Pakistan Intelligence Service, as this kind of like cohesive sort of thing. And it's not at all. I mean, it's a huge organization with, as anyone who knows a lot about Pakistan, with signed up officers and unofficial officers and people on the street who do bits and pieces. And not everybody has the same level of knowledge, and people do not share information either. I mean, I remain utterly convinced, having met General Pasha several times, that he had no idea that Osama was there in Abbottabad. And if you look at the fallout after after the killing, and the way that the army and the ISI reacted by just shutting everything down, I mean, they were as shocked as everybody else.
Right, right.
But in terms of how do you keep secrets within an organisation like that, it's very, very easy. Nobody tells anybody what's really going on.
You, I want to connect the dot back to your previous book, The Siege, as you establish in here that Osama bin Laden went to some kind of planning seminar for the attack. How much do you think Osama bin Laden was actually involved in the planning of 26/11, the attack on Mumbai?
That's a very difficult question. That was a Lashkar-e-Toiba plot, and a plot that had been discussed at certain levels within the ISI at different times as an idea, but not something that was actually going to be done. I don't believe he was involved personally in the decision-making process. He went out, not what people have said before, he went out on several occasions from Abbottabad to meet people and to show his face and have a bit of sort of mutual adulation. And I believe that meeting was one of those occasions. So he would have been aware that this plot was happening, but I don't believe he personally would have had wanted much to do with it, because it's not his focus.
Right.
India is not his focus. It's the West. It's America. It's the two holy mosques and the fight against Palestine. It's Israel, America.
One of the other things that is fascinating as the book is the tension that develops over time between bin Laden and his immediate hosts, the Kuwaitis, the two Pakistanis who'd lived in Kuwait and become known as the Kuwaitis, who are taking these enormous risks, in the end, risks that will cost them their lives. And he's not cooperating. Instead of keeping a low profile, he's trying to bring in his wives, his kids, everybody he's related to. And finally, they say enough is enough. Give us a little flavor of kind of the end of the story of Osama bin Laden and Abbottabad, and how what was going on in that hideout.
Well, from the wives' perspectives, I mean, they were never involved in the kind of the men's meetings. They were always sort of kept separate, but they felt a palpable sense of kind of tension between the companions, as they called them, who lived downstairs and in the annex outside, and Azama, who just would never give anything away in terms of kind of making a step forward or back to accommodate them. I mean, they've been stuck with him since Caliph Sheikh Mohammed
right.
who introduced them because he knew them from Kuwait. They grew up together. He introduced Ibrahim, the younger brother, who was the main companion to start with. In 2002 was when they first came up with the plan for him to live together with Osama and one wife and one baby. And then he had to bring his brother in because the family was just growing all the time and there was just too much to deal with and he couldn't do it on his own. And then Khalid Sheikh Mohammed was caught, so their boss was now no longer there to guide them. So by 2000, and I think towards the end of 2010, the two brothers kept going to see Osama and saying, look, we've dedicated our lives to you, but we're just tired, we're sick, we need a way out. You promised us that we would be able to retire and go and live in Saudi Arabia. You would give us some money so we could buy ourselves kind of retirement homes. And that time is now coming because we just can't cope anymore. And they had a series of meetings, some of which are documented in the letters, where Osama agreed to move out after the 10th anniversary of 9/11. And he was really happy that he'd got this kind of extension until September 2011. And his wives write about it as well and say, oh, we were living under such kind of tense security and tension in the house, and now this has been abated because we've got this extra sort of 9 months. And, of course, if he hadn't negotiated and he had moved out when they'd asked him to, he wouldn't have been there.
Right.
So he actually, right. in a way, sort of signed his own death warrant.
The family. You have September 11th. Bin Laden goes east into Pakistan, but a lot of the family and a lot of the other companions, especially some of the most senior, head off into Iran. And they spend the better part of the next decade in Iran. And as the book charts their course, it seems like they go from being under arrest in some pretty abysmal circumstances to being the toast of the town kind of Iran's royal couple behind the scenes. What is the course of this Iranian relationship with them and the family's relationship with Iran? And why were the Iranians playing this game with the bin Laden family?
Well, I guess you'd rather have, A, your enemy's enemy is your friend.
Right.
They have a common enemy in America and Israel. B, you'd rather have them kind of where you can see them, rather than them attacking you, which had happened in the past from Afghanistan with al-Qaeda attacks on Iran. And there had been previous collaborations. I mean, the Mauritanian spiritual advisor who I met, spent a lot of time with, had gone on Osama's say-so to Tehran in 1995 with Saif al-Adil to negotiate some kind of mutual deal to get al-Qaeda fighters trained by Hezbollah in the Bekaa Valley. Whether or not that actually happened in the end, mm-hmm. we can't prove it. He wouldn't say. But that those connections were already there. And I guess Iran saw an opportunity at that time to assist and take some power and take some control that these people could be useful at some stage in the future. And in fact, one of the most shocking elements I found of this story was the fact that after welcoming the family and several very significant Shura members to Tehran, the Iranian government, the civilian government, then contacted the US government here, Washington, and said, look, we've got these people. Would you want them in return for diplomatic kind of easing of sanctions and restoring of relations? And that offer was turned down in 2003. So the world would be a very different place if that right. had been taken up.
Just after the Axis of Evil
yeah.
speech and all that.
Yes. The discussion had preceded the Axis of Evil speech,
mm-hmm.
And then it kind of shut down at that point because obviously Tehran was very, very upset. But it was restarted again in 2003, and then formally turned down later that year.
The central figure in the Iranian government
all of this process of dealing with the bin Laden families is Qasem Soleimani, the head of the Iranian Revolutionary Guards, Quds Force, a man who has taken on almost mythic proportions for his role in Lebanon and Syria and Iraq. Why was it his portfolio? And what does this say about the deep state in Iran and its power in influencing Iranian behavior?
Well, it was his portfolio because as head of the Quds Force, he's in charge of clandestine foreign operations, anything that can assist or otherwise the state of Iran. So
right.
To have al-Qaeda's, to have Osama bin Laden's nearest and dearest under lock and key, or at least sort of within four walls, within the main training facility of the Quds Force in Tehran, is much better than not knowing what al-Qaeda are up to. And to then have several key members of the Shura also held in the same compound, initially separately, but eventually they were all together, means you can then negotiate with al-Qaeda to mutual benefit. And so by 2003, when the Shura, that was not in, still in Pakistan, so not the Zawahiri group, al-Qaeda central, but Saif al-Adl and Muhammad, Abu Muhammad al-Masri and Abu Akher al-Masri, quite a lot of Egyptians, they were by that stage in a position to plan and execute attacks remotely from Tehran, like the Riyadh compound bombings.
Right.
And the relationship, I mean, the relationship, yeah, as you say, was very up and down between these people and the Quds Force and Major General Qasem Soleimani. But they were able to re-establish a funding pipeline through Iran, which still exists today. Mm-hmm. So these days the money comes from Kuwait and Qatar and goes to Syria and Iraq. A lot of it used to go to Pakistan. But, I mean,
right.
Those networks and infrastructures were established during that decade. So, I mean, it's a very, very crucial period, I think, that's always been overlooked and misunderstood.
The highlight, at least for me, of this relationship, which I want you to describe a little bit, is that Soleimani brings Osama bin Laden's sons to attend a speech by Ayatollah Khamenei, which they're kind of...
Around the back.
Right. If it was the equivalent of Falk, they would have been in the room over there. Did Khamenei know... Or I guess we don't know whether he knows.
I don't know.
Right.
I haven't interviewed him.
But it's kind of a remarkable moment. Here are the sons of bin Laden attending a speech by the Supreme Leader as a guest.
I think, and it was done to make up for a period of huge instability that had preceded it, because there had been a clampdown on the freedom. I mean, they weren't free. The family and the Shura were not free to kind of wander around Tehran. They were held within four walls, within this huge military compound. But they'd had a very bad period preceding this, where one of the not a Shura member, a Kuwaiti guy called Suleiman Abu Ghaith, who's now in prison in America. He had found out that his wife had been able to make a couple of phone calls home. And he'd found out that his wife back in Kuwait had divorced him and gone off with his best friend, and that his seven children with her were now living with their grandparents. And so he went on hunger strike because he was completely distraught about this, because most other people in the compound had their families with them and he was on his own. And they had a riot and burnt some cars, and everything had gone very badly wrong. So I guess Soleimani's idea was to try and give them a treat. Restore relations. It's a long time to keep people locked up. You have to negotiate and give and take.
And how does it all come to an end? I mean, in the end, I'm not sure that all of them, but the vast majority of the al-Qaeda entourage leaves Iran. How does it come to an end? Why do the Iranians finally let these people go?
Well, I don't think they have finally let them go. I think they still connect, and I think work together is probably too strong a word, but there is still mutual benefit to be had in Syria and Iraq between the Quds Force and Soleimani and Saif al-Adl, who's now back there. playing a very active role, mm-hmm. along with his deputies and assistants, apart from the one who was killed. Abu Akher al-Masri was killed in Idlib,
right.
in February this year. But, I mean, they're now back in the fight and assisting with Jalani, the Jabhat Fateh al-Sham
right.
group. So that is an ongoing relationship. I mean, different people left at different times. I guess the family, initially people escaped. So quite soon after the going to the Grand Mosque incident, where they went to listen to the Supreme Leader, relations disintegrated again to the point where the family group almost escaped from the compound and they got as far as the main gate. And the women sat down behind the main gate and started chanting to people in the street, saying, "We're being held against our will, get us out," type thing. And it was very touch and go whether the escorts who were looking after the family would actually get things back under control. But soon after this, when relations were very bad in 2008, Saad bin Laden, one of Osama's sons, escaped. And he made it to Pakistan and was then killed in a drone strike. By accident, in the wrong place at the wrong time. And then his younger sister, 16-year-old sister, Iman, escaped by going... The women sometimes were allowed to go out on shopping trips with Iranian escorts, female escorts, so they were going on a special Eid shopping trip to a fancy supermarket in the middle of the city. And she got... she kind of picked some clothes up off the shelves and changed into a kind of Iranian... westernized outfit out of her black abaya and picked up a baby doll and wrapped it up and walked out. And they didn't even realize that she was gone until sort of 10 minutes later, and suddenly they got all the women back together and, hang on, someone's missing.
Right.
So, I mean, people left at different times, and once these escapes had started happening, they began a process, the Iranians began a process of negotiated releases, which was assisted by Al-Qaeda kidnapping several Iranian diplomats in Pakistan and Yemen. So the family went first, but at different times. So Osama's eldest wife, Khairiyya, she went in 2010 and rejoined her husband. Everybody in the family believes that she was tracked. She had some kind of tracking device, which Osama writes about in his letters as she's
right.
coming.
Right.
He's like, go and check the dentist, go and check your teeth, go and check under your skin. They were very worried about her coming,
mm-hmm.
and I do believe that the evidence suggests that she was tracked, and her reunion with Osama was a critical factor in the reaching of in the linking him to Abbottabad, to finding him in Abbottabad. So people escaped at different times. People were released at different times.
You mentioned already one
the relationship other. Continues though.
Right. You mentioned already one very important figure, Hamza, who is now being
touted,
groomed to be the next leader of Al-Qaeda. What's his glide path before 2011-2012?
Well, he was a kid. I mean, he was... According to, I've not met him, obviously.
Right.
He's on the run and probably in Karachi. But according to his brothers, he was the only one who kind of really wanted to kind of join his father in his activities. And one of his older brothers, Omar, told me the story of when they were living in Kandahar one time, and Osama came along, pinned up a sheet in the little mosque in the airport village where they lived. And it was kind of like, sign up here if you want to be a suicide bomber. He kind of looked at his sons, sort of, any of you going to put your names down? And Hamza, apparently, according to Omar, put his name down, and none of the others did. But, I mean, he was a kid, and he'd spent, up until 2001, when he was 13, he had always lived within the kind of Al-Qaeda sort of desert sort of kingdom of Al-Qaeda living in Afghanistan. And then he went with his family to Pakistan, and then went to Iran, where he was held for 10 years. When he was released in 2010, along with his mother, who's Khairiyya, one of Osama's deputies wrote and said to Osama, look, you're expecting too much of him. He spent his whole life in incarceration. He has studied and is very religious, and he's very ambitious, and he wants to kind of fight and to join the jihad, but just he's had no experience at all. And there was quite a tussle between the deputy and Osama as to sort of how far they could push Hamza. Mm-hmm. And that process of kind of pushing him as the heir and the figurehead and the handsome, resembling his father, character has continued to this day. So other family members, who I still talk to now, they're very worried that he, we shouldn't be sympathetic, but they're very worried that he is just a, as his sister said, they're not his words that he speaks on the videos. There's Wahiri's words. He's just a puppet.
Being used.
Being used. But to great effect, because obviously people are going around and doing heinous acts on Al-Qaeda's say-so.
Was he in the hideout in Abbottabad when the SEALs came that's
no.
been alleged?
He'd been there very briefly, 2 or 3 days beforehand. So he had been reunited with his father, but he'd then been told to go off down to Karachi. And to, his father's deputy had kind of convinced Osama by this stage that he wasn't ready and that he should go and study for some time and go and meet with other Shura members and get some real experience before he started doing anything.
I'm going to go to the audience and just another question or two. I want to bring up one other figure, Abu Musayyib al-Zarqawi, the Jordanian founder of Al-Qaeda in Iraq and, by derivation, in a way, the spiritual founder of the Islamic State, man the Islamic State holds up as. He has a similar journey of going from Afghanistan through Iran to Iraq, and then his communications link back to Al-Qaeda Central also go through Iran. Is it an overstatement to say that the Iranians helped create Al-Qaeda in Iraq and therefore have some responsibility,
I do believe that. And part of the reason that happened was because after Iran offered to handle these people over to America or another Western country, whoever, and they were turned down, they thought, right, well, now we're going to do what we want with them. We're going to use them. We're going to cause problems for America. So the war in Iraq was just starting, which is part of the reason that this deal was not done, because it was the wrong country. The war, it was Saddam Hussein and Al-Qaeda, not Tehran and Al-Qaeda. So so the Iranian government, assisted Zarqawi in many, many different ways, and Saif al-Adel. I mean, they were part of the same group, and then Zarqawi went off to northern Iraq, to Kurdish territory, and started plotting from there attacks against American forces in Iraq, and all of it funded. And he crossed back over to go to Pakistan on certain occasions. It's all very well documented. I think one of the things, and this isn't my story, this is a story from a CIA analyst, that's most shocking is that shortly before the famous Colin Powell speech to the United Nations about weapons of mass destruction,
right,
and Al-Qaeda and Saddam Hussein connections, that the CIA had established that there was this guy called Zarqawi,
right,
in northern Iraq, and they used his discovery, rather than to kind of take him out, which was the recommendation, they used his discovery to put together the link between him and Saddam, and the link was not there. I mean, he was already plotting against Saddam. So does that answer your question?
Yes,
I'm
mean,
sure.
the part of the alleged link with Saddam was that Zarqawi had been injured and had either lost a leg or had...
No, that's not true.
And when he was finally brought to justice, one of the first things that he was checked on by the American team that arrived at the bomb was his legs. And his legs had survived a, 5,000-pound bomb, and it was pretty clear that he'd never undergone leg surgery. So that whole connection turned out to be...
Yeah. That was that. I mean, there was an eyewitness that we interviewed. The Mauritanian was with him when that incident happened. They were in the Taliban media office in Kandahar, in November, December 2001, when a bomb dropped. In fact, Mauritania had just left, and Abu Zubaydah and Zarqawi and various other people were in the building, got flattened, but they all came out alive. Injured, but not severely.
As I said at the beginning, it's as it says itself, it's the stunning inside story. Much of this detail never been revealed before. And I'd like to open it up to questions now. Please raise your hand. We have a microphone that will come around and identify yourself. And please, let's keep it to questions, not to statements. Don't be bashful. Right here in the front. I have to warn you, I am extremely nearsighted, so people in the back, you're in trouble.
Thank you. Larry Checco, Checco Communications. This is not off topic, but I'm just curious. I have little experience with Muslim countries, but what's it like for a woman to have to go into a situation with men, as powerful as these men were or are, and get them to talk to you? I mean, it's my understanding, and I've seen it, that they don't even look women in the eye. So I'm interested in learning how you were able to bridge that gap.
That was something I was also concerned. I mean, I've worked a lot in Pakistan, but I mean, that's not the same kind of country as talking to sort of Arabs from Al-Qaeda. And I was concerned about that at the beginning. But A, you get underestimated because you're just a woman. And B, what is said in public for the home audience and what you actually do in private when you meet someone is completely different. So we had pictures together and I shook hands with people. I mean, I was very surprised. I wasn't expecting that at all. We had meals together. I mean, officially, some of these people, like MacDeesey, wouldn't even sort of enter a room with another woman. But as long as I was there to sort of listen to his message and act as his mouthpiece, which is what he intended, then he was happy to sit down with me on the same couch. So.
My name is Doris Belinsky. I'm retired. I'm just interested in the topic. From what you say, it seems Al-Qaeda is still pretty powerful. The media seems to give the impression Al-Qaeda is on the way down and Islamic State is more powerful at the moment. Could you discuss that, please?
I think Al-Qaeda will always be powerful as an idea and a much more cohesive idea than Islamic State. A much more sophisticated idea than Islamic State. And as long as they have people backing them and promoting their cause who have a kind of a proper theological background and are respected internationally like the clerics in Jordan, then they're like the granddaddies. And I see Islamic State are like the kind of the kids on the block. I mean, this is probably far too trite a way to describe it, but they will always, because of the 9/11 attacks, I mean, in their eyes, that was the greatest stunt, terrible word to use, but the greatest thing that had ever been achieved. So they will always have that kudos and respect, which I don't think comes in the same way from ploughing a van into a group of people going out on a Saturday night in London, on London Bridge. So, I mean, it's... They're running a business. I mean, this for them is a business. You meet these clerics, I'm not going to name particular people now, but I mean, it's all about PR. It's all about kind of what can I associate myself with? Can I put myself out there? And the better, the guys who've been doing it longer are better at the PR and they know what they can get away with and what they can say and what they don't need to say in order to get hoiked off to Manhattan and put on trial. They're in a different league from the ISIS, Islamic State guys in Raqqa.
I agree with all that. I would add one other thing. Bin Laden and Zawahiri were always careful what they promised, not to promise what they couldn't deliver. Baghdadi has promised what he can't deliver, that A, he's the caliph, B, the caliphate is returning, and see, the end of time is about to come.
All of which is ridiculous.
Right, all of which is ridiculous. And I think Zawahiri has been smart enough to know, give them enough rope, they will end up being failures, and then people will naturally gravitate back to the people who told you the right answer.
Yes, absolutely.
Sure.
Herb Rose, I'm wondering if you or anyone else has been able to determine why the U.S. government turned down the offer of the Iranians in 2003.
I believe it was because war in Iraq was already well advanced as an idea. It hadn't yet been launched, but to go after Iran was going after the wrong message at that time, because Saddam Hussein was the focus, was the target, and the government at that time had made such an effort to connect him to al-Qaeda that for Iran to hand over Osama bin Laden's family and a good chunk of the al-Qaeda military council and ruling Shura outside of the military council would have not been on message.
Over here, the gentleman in the blue.
Hi, I'm Viresh Sharma. There are stories that there was a Pakistani woman who was very keenly involved in tracking Osama. Is that true?
A Pakistani woman involved in tracking bin Laden?
Through CIA or whatever the group that was tracking?
Because I don't know about that at all, I'm afraid.
Even in the movie they showed, but she is a composite. So.
No, I don't know. I'm afraid I don't know at all about that.
I would advise anyone, you referred to the movie, I think it's Zero Dark Thirty or something like that. It may be a good movie. It has nothing to do with what actually
If you have
happened.
Any information, can we talk about it afterwards? Okay.
Over here.
Hello, I'm Tomoe from Japan, and I'm going to start reading your book just today, so please forgive me asking about this question. It may be relating to the like former question about the movie, but I don't know. I'm not talking about the film itself. You know, like there have been so many arguments so far about Al-Qaeda and Bin Laden, so if you tell me, like, what aspects are particularly new in your book? And I mean, like, in other words, or what point would you say are particularly different from the past studies? Thank you.
I think my main aim was to listen to Arab voices and tell the story of Al-Qaeda as much as possible from Al-Qaeda people, and to tell the story of Osama bin Laden's last 10 years from the perspective of the people who were with him, not from here or London or wherever. I wanted to hear their voices, their accounts, because life is complicated and people do things for different reasons. And I was just, going back to what I said right at the beginning, I was initially fascinated to know what it would have been like living with him. Did his wives agree with him? Did they all go around cheering when the attacks happened? Did they support him? Did they want to be suicide bombers? I mean, these were the questions, because there was a total absence of answers from those people. It was a vacant space. So that was the aim of the book. And I guess people have to judge whether we've succeeded or not.
Hi, I'm Jack Kropansky, unaffiliated. All the people you talk to, how do they think of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed? Is he just kind of do they talk about him in the past tense, or what will happen when we ever decide what we're going to do with him? What impact might that have on Al-Qaeda?
Well, he's a fascinating Machiavellian character, because he was never in Al-Qaeda, and he was a freelance troublemaker who came up with some crazy plots. I mean, he had been bugging bin Laden for years about the idea that had initially been put together by his nephew, Ramzi Yousef, when he bombed the World Trade Center in 1993. And Ramzi came up with the planes idea. And Khalid Sheikh Mohammed thought this was a fantastic sort of way to affect maximum casualties. Initially, when he went to see Azama in 1996 to talk about it in Tora Bora, Azama had no money and no people and no nothing. He liked the idea, but just said, I'm sorry, I can't do this now. And then after they attacked different targets, so the USS Cole and also the African embassy bombings of 1998, money started flowing in. So Khalid Sheikh Mohammed was back up to Tora Bora and then to Kandahar saying, right, so should we go for this now? This will give you the biggest spectacular you could, beyond your wildest imagination. He'll never be released. I had a really interesting insight about him from James Mitchell, who everyone describes as sort of the architect of the CIA torture program, but it's not quite straight. Right. But, he describes him, and he spent more time with him than anyone else since he was captured, interrogating him and waterboarding him, and he describes him as an evil Yoda. He's a very small guy, unbelievably hairy, and still, still intensely kind of energetic and determined that his way is the right way. And apparently his kind of now his idea is that we will consume ourselves, we will destroy ourselves, and that the Muslim world can just wait and watch us kind of fall on our own swords, and the damage has already been done. So I think he's a very, very devious and deeply evil individual.
To editorialize just for a minute, and the great tragedy here is he probably will never be put on a public stage.
No, which is terrible.
Right, where his evil would come through. And we spend an inordinate amount of time, both in Washington and London, talking about countering violent extremism. But one of the best ways to counter violent extremism would be to put some of the violent extremists on trial, where they had to account for their actions and where they will expose themselves. I'm confident that had he been tried 8 years ago, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed would have undermined his cause.
But he would have loved that opportunity, and he would love that opportunity to get up on a stage and expand about why he did this. I would slightly disagree with you on that, because I think these people want an audience. They want to put their story out there. And given an audience, I'm sure he would do a pretty good job of convincing not you or me or anybody here, but there'll be lots of people who'll be just, wow, I mean, this guy's got it all right.
Well, I think it's a pretty hypothetical question.
Yes.
So
yes.
We'll never know the answer to that. In the back, sir.
Hi, David Schulenberger. Do you have a notion what's in the documents that were taken at Abbottabad that have not been released?
I haven't seen them, so I would be speculating, but I would imagine it will be more of what we have seen, which is a combination of family letters and a lot about strategy, future attacks, future development of the Al-Qaeda affiliates in Yemen and other countries. I think it would be hugely important for those documents to be opened up to, not necessarily to public scrutiny, but to proper scrutiny. I mean, what I understand from people who have seen the few, you included, that nobody's read a lot of this material. It's literally in boxes, and given that Al-Qaeda is still very much a relevant force, whether or not it's having a bit of a lull at the moment, I mean, it will be there for the foreseeable future for all of us. I think it's really important to study the strategy and future plans of its original leader, because Zawahiri is continuing in his own vein, but he is continuing with that plan, using the son as his kind of adjunct and handsome young figurehead. But, I mean, why lock it all away? But I know, I don't know in detail. I think you can probably answer that question better than I.
Well, I don't know in detail either, but I think they would reveal several things. A lot more about the connections between bin Laden, the Kuwaiti brothers, and their various facilitators in Pakistan. I don't think you will find the phone number of the Chief of Army Staff or something like that. I think the administration's been honest. There is no smoking gun. There wasn't somewhere in the hideout a secure telephone that picked you up and General Kayani answered at the other end. I think that's not there. But I think a lot more of the texture of relations with Hamid Gul, Lashkar-e-Taiba, and things like that would be there.
And plans, future plans.
And that's when the documents were received in the United States in summer of 2011. The intelligence community did what it should do, which is as quickly as possible search them to see if there was ongoing plans that needed to be disrupted or information about the location of individuals that you wanted to go after. And I think anyone who looks at the pattern of drone attacks in the summer of 2011 has to say, there's an awful interesting spike here of confirmed kills. Where did all of this information suddenly come from? And I think the answer is there. The problem is that in the intelligence community, once that quick and dirty exploitation is done, there's no follow-up to do the kinds of things that Kathy was talking about, which is study how does the organization work, what is the ethos of the organization, and what can we learn long-term about how this organization operates so that we can deal with it not just today, but 10 or 20 years from now. That kind of long-term analysis is not prized in the American intelligence community. Much more important is the immediate, what can you do for me tonight kind of thing. That's why turning it over to a institution that would allow scholars to come in and look at it would, in the long term, be a very big benefit to the whole business of countering violent extremism. We would know more about how violent extremism works.
And why wouldn't you do that?
Right.
The material's there. It's sitting somewhere in Virginia. Why box it up and lock it away? It's crazy.
And whatever is in there after 6 years, you're not going to find the address of somebody you want to go after. You can be pretty sure by now anyone whose address is in there long ago moved someplace else. So there's very little damage that would be done. But
Mike Flynn, who was head of DIA at the time, as he argued, we need to plot our future strategy and we need to understand our enemy. And he had a huge legal fight, I think, to try and get more access to the documentation, which he ultimately lost. But, I mean, that's one point in which I agree with him. I mean, why would you not study the strategy of your enemy when you're gifted all this material? Why would you just lock it away?
Exactly. Exactly. More questions? Over here, Ms. Chandler. Either one.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm Syed Hassan. I used to work with Catholic University. I'm from Afghanistan, so we're familiar with the politics in Afghanistan and Iran. What I'm wondering about, because before that I was thinking that the Iranian government occasionally and on case are ready to work with Al-Qaeda, but not as a substantial and very ideological work, because Shia and Wahhabi and all of them make problem. If we look at the cases like Yemen and even in some part of Iraq and Syria, we see there is a conflict. But what I get right now from you, it bring to me this idea that maybe you think there is a more substantial coalition and cooperation between Al-Qaeda and Iran, or still it's only the cooperation on a particular cases and occasionally on some particular occasion. Thank you.
I think it's a particular case. I mean, obviously, ideologically, the country and the organisation could not be more opposed, but they have common interests. And as I said earlier on, I mean, it's better to know where your enemy is and to get them to work with you against the greater enemy than be in conflict and not know what each other is doing. But it was a fraught relationship. From the people who were in Iran, from Al-Qaeda, who I interviewed, it went up and down all the time. And there was complete mutual distrust on both sides for the whole time that they were there. But common ground is found, I guess, in strange situations.
This is Suleyman Özeren from, I am a research scholar at George Mason. And I'm studying on issues of like Al-Qaeda and ISIS for a long time. These terrorist organizations, if they continue to inflict pain, you know, carry out terrorist attacks, they also continue to attract new recruits. And that's why we see attacks in London and other places. Maybe some of these attacks were not really coordinated by ISIS, but claiming responsibility to help ISIS. And now we are seeing a kind of repositioning of countries in the Middle East into different paths, you know, Saudi Arabia, Egypt, and versus, you know, Qatar and Iran, maybe. What is your opinion about the future of Al-Qaeda in these developments? What will be the next step for Al-Qaeda in terms of emergence of Al-Qaeda as an again in the region as a group, or as he indicated, or are they going to extend another rope to another organization?
I don't think Al-Qaeda, kind of central, for want of a better word, is going to carry out a kind of coordinated, home-based mass attack. I think those days have gone. I think it's right at the beginning of Al-Qaeda, when Osama bin Laden formed it with Abdullah Azzam, his idea was to create a base, a kind of a movement that would inspire people. I mean, they then got sidetracked and actually committed attacks by themselves, which caused a lot of argument within the Shura, because a lot of the Shura members said, we shouldn't be doing these attacks, we should be the inspiration behind attacks for other people to commit. And I think we've now moved on to, as we can see in the UK just in the last week, to people being inspired by a movement. And I think that's Al-Qaeda's future role, sadly, is to inspire people who are disaffected. And I mean, there is a lot to be disaffected about as well. I mean, coming from London, I mean, everybody talks about kind of what's happened in the last few days over the attack, but no one talks about kind of why these guys decide to get a van and plow into people on a Saturday night in London Bridge. It's because of the wars in the Middle East. It's because of the hundreds of thousands of people who've died, become refugees. It's because of the kind of internalising of European countries against refugees. It's because of travel bans, and the world is becoming a very kind of compartmentalised place. And I think part of the reason we wanted to write this book was to kind of say, well, look, we can't just sit outside this and kind of go, you're wrong, this is terrible. You need to understand where people are coming from. And I think Al-Qaeda's role is to inspire people who see the world from a different perspective, from a Muslim, Middle Eastern, Palestinian, whatever, perspective, which is not the perspective we see it from here. That kind of answer your question.
Lady in white on this side.
Hi, I'm Medea Afzal. I'm at the University of Maryland and also a non-resident fellow here at Brookings. And I have a couple of questions. I'll try to be brief. The first one has to do with Carlotta Gall's book, in which she actually says that a source told her that there was an ISI desk to handle Osama. And you said that there were certainly elements within that, but did you receive any corroboration of a specific desk. Okay.
No. Right. No. But I mean, I'm not critiquing or criticizing what she was told. But the information I was given, it was much more loose, and it was much more organized by senior former ISI officers. There's not a kind of a desk in Abhara in ISI headquarters that's got kind of a Osama bin Laden written on it.
Okay.
It doesn't work like that. But I mean, she, I'm sure, has got impeccable sources.
Thanks. So that's, and just very quickly, if you could talk a little bit about the relationship between Al-Qaeda in those sort of waning years before Osama bin Laden died and the Tehrik-e-Taliban Pakistan and Mullah Omar and what the relationship was between them at that point.
I think with the TTP, the relationship was very fraught and there was a lot of discussion, the Pakistan-Taliban. There was a lot of discussion in letters between Osama and his kind of number two in the tribal areas, Atiya al-Rahman, who was working closely with the TTP, but very upset that they were very not lawless. They were just very disorganized and attacking a lot of targets in Pakistan, civilian targets, Shia targets, Ahmadi targets, whatever, and which Al-Qaeda was not happy about. So there was a lot of discussion about how to get the TTP under control because Osama and Atiya and other people within Al-Qaeda Central felt that the TTP was taking the movement and the goal in the wrong direction. And do you say Mullah Omar as well, head of the Taliban? There's one letter that Osama wrote only about 2 months before he died, which was released, where he's had a letter from Mullah Omar, which he's absolutely delighted about because they fell out really badly, because after Mullah Omar and the Taliban gave Al-Qaeda sanctuary in Afghanistan, and then Al-Qaeda started attacking targets and then bringing all the attention to Afghanistan and the war. And, I mean, there was one final meeting at which the Mauritanian attended along with Osama's son, Omar, between Mullah Omar and Osama, and they had fallen out so badly that Mullah Omar had been invited for lunch, invited to talk about kind of how can Al-Qaeda sort of calm down and stop bringing bad attention towards the Islamic State, because the Islamic State was still kind of trying to grow and formalise itself. And Mullah Omar was allegedly so angry with Osama and his reluctance to kind of back down and say, yes, we'll behave ourselves and we won't kind of do all this bad stuff, that he stomped off without having lunch and sat in a chair, and Osama was sitting on the carpet, and that was the last time they ever met. They were supposed to meet on the first day of the war, the American war, in October 2001, but that meeting didn't happen because the US drone, I think, dropped something on them, on Mullah Omar's compound. But yes, at the end of his life, Osama received a letter from Mullah Omar, and he was very pleased that he'd written to send his respects and good wishes. And I think had he not been killed, he would have tried to rekindle that relationship. But luckily, they're both now dead.
If I could editorialize one more time, for anyone who wants to do a book project, somebody needs to write a book about Mullah Omar, one of the most important people of this century. A man who hosted Osama bin Laden, the man who figured out how to defeat the American military in Afghanistan and NATO, a man who died, and for 2 years we didn't know he was dead. It's a remarkable story.
You can't make this stuff up.
You can't make this one up. This one is too good to be true, and what we don't know is what is really true of his story. It's amazing. We've been at war now in Afghanistan for 16 years. We don't have a single quality biography of the man who's led the war against us for most of those years. I'll stop my editorializing there. The gentleman in the back.
Hi, I'm Bilal Hay, and I'm from the Embassy of Pakistan. I appreciate for your insight. And since I haven't had the opportunity to glimpse through the entire books, but I just wanted to ask your comment if you had the opportunity to look into some of the documents that have been declassified and put on website by the DNI. This is, I think, from the collection taken from the OBL compound. And in one of the documents that I was able to see, it talks about the position of the Pakistani regime on the war against Islam. And here, probably the OBL himself talks about that Pakistan played the main role in defeating the Islamic Emirate in Afghanistan, that Pakistani regime arrested more than 800 foreign mujahideen and handed them over to America. And then he also goes on that when mujahideen could not find safe havens in the tribal areas of Pakistan, which were once a hospitable area to them, because Pakistani forces began a series of military operations against them in these areas, aiming to defeat them totally, or at least to distract them from carrying out jihadi operations against America and NATO. So these were the justifications of OBL to inspire and motivate his followers to wage jihad inside Pakistan against the state of Pakistan and Pakistan's military forces. Because according to his view, Pakistani state was the main impediment in furthering their cause of global jihad. So would you comment on that? Thank you.
I haven't seen those documents. I would like to see those documents. But I think some of what you say is right, that that Osama and al-Qaeda viewed the state of Pakistan as an enemy. And in fact, there were several attempts in the early days of Musharraf's presidency where he was, sorry, two attempts on his life because they saw Musharraf as doing America's bidding, signing up to the war on terror, launching attacks in Waziristan, closing down their bases in places like Shikai Valley. So yes, I mean, Pakistan has suffered a lot from al-Qaeda attacks post 9/11 and prior to 9/11. But yes, but I'd like to see those documents. I haven't seen them. Thank you.
Gentleman right here.
Great, thanks. Rob Boone from the World Bank. You mentioned that you see al-Qaeda being around for some time and, you know, being, you know, having some staying power. And you also mentioned some of the reasons that people are motivated to join and support it. So in light of that, and the, as you said, to getting the perspective of, Muslim and middle people in the Middle East. So what would your guidance be to countries that are, feeling the effects of the different attacks, whether in the West or even in the region? Be to address this form of violent extremism? Because you've clearly made allusions to certain things that you don't think are productive. So what do you think would be?
That's a huge question. I think understanding motivation is really important, and engaging with people who are pushing the al-Qaeda line or pushing the theology or the clerical support. I think it's really important to reach out to those people. Some of the clerics in Jordan, for example. I mean, people all around the world, that they're not officially in al-Qaeda, but Osama bin Laden listened to them and quoted from them. They're sitting there in Amman, and what they say is read on the internet by a huge number of people. And I think until you can start sitting down and engaging with them about what's wrong and understanding why they believe what they do believe and addressing some of the, I'm not in government, I'm just a journalist, but addressing some of the core issues of Palestine and Israel. And I think you have to kind of not put yourself in their shoes, but you have to, rather than just fight it, you have to understand and talk to them. That's all I can say, but what am I?
But they're not bashful.
No, they'd love to talk.
Right. Ayman Zarqawi has told us endlessly why he, quote, hates us. And it is all about Israel, about Palestine, about perceived Western injustices to the Islamic world.
I mean, did anyone see, I don't actually know if it's a genuine video, but there was a video of a Palestinian girl who was shot the other day. And she was shot by, I don't know if it was Israeli Defense Forces, but anyhow, she was shot and people were shouting at her as she was lying injured on the ground. And this is all videoed. And she died. She's 14, like the day after. I mean, if I'm a young Muslim man or woman watching that on the internet, you can begin to understand why people get so angry. And there's no response to that. But I'm not at all kind of vindicating what people do. I just think we need to kind of understand better.
As we're both saying, if we want to know the answer to the question, why do they hate us? They've told us. We don't seem to want to receive the message. That doesn't mean you have to endorse their view or their objectives. But there's no mystery as to why we have Islamic extremists and a lot of people who are willing to support them. I want to raise one other question as well. There's another country in this mix that we haven't really talked about, but which is Osama bin Laden's homeland. You've talked to members of the family, some of whom now have gone back and are living in Saudi Arabia. What are their living conditions like? Are they? I'm sure they're pretty carefully monitored by Saudi authorities, but have the bin Laden family been rehabilitated, or are parts of it still beyond the pale? How is the bin Ladens now treated inside the kingdom?
If you're talking about the kind of Osama bin Laden
right.
bit of the family, which is completely separate from the larger bin Laden corporation and brothers and sisters who had nothing at all to do with Al-Qaeda. I mean, the family had been split. So basically the four wives and his eldest daughter, Fatima, who's lost two husbands, one of whom's here. They are in Jeddah and they have been rehabilitated. I mean, they are looked after by the family, who gives them accommodation and money. But, I mean, they have a very, very limited life. Fatima is not, because her husband is, the first husband died and the second one is on a life sentence here in Colorado. She can't leave the house. Her children can't go to school. This is more for cultural reasons than anything else, because she's on her own. I mean, they're not short of money at all. Mm-hmm. But in some ways their life hasn't changed for the women, because they've always lived behind closed doors in sort of hidden away. Their views are not kind of understood, or nobody's interested in their views or what they have to say. So they've just been transplanted from one compound to another one, but no longer with any threat, because he's gone. And most sons, excluding Hamza, now live in Doha, in Qatar, in a quite a bizarre cul-de-sac, which I've been to, where kind of they've been put together. They have six different houses. There's lots of different sons, and they all have children and families. But they've been put together with Saddam Hussein's wife, lives in another house around the corner, and Yasser Arafat's daughter, until recently, lived in a house. And there's a sheikh, an Egyptian sheikh, whose name I can't remember, but he's called the Sheikh of Death. And they all live in West Bay, near to the Pearl in Qatar, in Doha, sorry, in government houses, which are given to them rent-free, with nice cars, and the shopping's done for them. And they're doing quite well. I think they're having a better time than the women in Jeddah.
Well, that's a community association that we really want to get inside of and know more about. I think we have time for one more question. All the way in the back.
Hi, I'm Gabriele Dreva. I'm a recent graduate from Georgetown University. As a wrap-up question, I guess, since we're the center of 21st century security and intelligence, you mentioned that Iran and Al-Qaeda share some common interests. They have some common interests, and I believe they share some contacts, namely the Taliban. What is your take on the future of the relationship between Al-Qaeda and the Taliban? Do you see the Taliban eventually giving up their ties to Al-Qaeda to gain international respectability? You know, Iran has contacts, Russia has been revealing it has contacts. So what is your take on that? And is that a way to weaken Al-Qaeda, or are there other ways?
I'm not an expert on the Taliban at all. I kind of study them in as far as their relationship, historical relationship with Al-Qaeda, but I think the Taliban at the moment are very weakened because they've had their leader, well, one leader died and we didn't know he was dead, and then the next one was taken out by American drone in Balochistan last year. So I think, and the new leader is a very old school member of the Taliban. I think, I'm not sure if I'm qualified to speak about it, really. What I believe, and I don't know this from based on any interviews, is that the Taliban views the whole Al-Qaeda, Osama bin Laden period of residency as the worst element of their history, because it destroyed the Islamic Emirate. Al-Qaeda came in like a magpie and took the place to pieces. So I can't imagine in the long term that the Taliban would want to continue that relationship, but that then doesn't take account of organisations like the Haqqani Network, which kind of are in the middle. So I don't feel qualified to really answer your question, I'm afraid.
I want to thank you very much, Kathy. I believe this is the first book event in the States for The Exile. I understand you've graciously agreed to sign books at the desk outside, so I urge all of you to get a copy. You really only scratched the surface in the last hour and a half. There's a lot more to understand and to learn and to think about in this book. Thank you very much again.
Thank you.